We'd like to welcome all of you to our celebration feast of folktales, poetry, and song and dance from many parts of our world. And to start us out in the spirit of things, Verlon and Terry are going to teach us their version of Wade in the Water.
We're only going to do three verses of this song because that's all of them I can remember. I knew there's a lot more of them, but I don't know. Three of them's pretty good to get wound up on. The chorus goes like this. I don't know, I suppose you heard it in Vespers, some of you that were here, choir sang it. But it's real easy to, it's a real easy song to sing. In between phrases, you sing, wade in the water. And then the chorus goes, wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. I'll go through the first verse. I'll just sing through the first verse to kind of get the idea when to cut in.
Who's that yonder dressed in red? Wade in the water. Must be the children Moses led. Wade in the water. Wade in the water. Wade in the water, children. Wade in the water. God's gonna trouble.
When God created you and me, was there only one color of face that was meant to be? Or did God stretch and widen and deepen an imagination to create a family of humankind in a rainbow celebration? At times, it seems, we forget all the others, our black, our brown, our tan sisters and brothers. And so tonight entails dance, song, and rhyme. We would like to celebrate a feast of life for all time. Words and music that come from many places, thoughts and feelings from many different faces. Our beat, our songs, our words may not be the same, yet all of us praise God's holy name. A folk tale from Tanzania is the place where a monkey and a lizard come face to face.
I have a little story that I think you will like. about a monkey who was black and a lizard who was white. And Kwambu, the monkey, was walking one day when he met Nkendi, the lizard. So he stopped to say, "Listen, my friend, come to my house and eat. I promise I'll fix you a very special treat." With delight, the lizard asked, "When will this be?" And Nkwambu, the monkey, said, "Tomorrow, I'm free." The monkey hurried home to tell his wife, 'cause they never fed a lizard in their entire life. The monkey said, "Lizards like intestines of a fish." His wife said, "You really think that's a tasty dish?" The monkey said, "I'm off to see our chief, for I'm sure he'll agree to make our friend the lizard part of our family." When the lizard arrived the next day to dawn, everything was prepared, especially fine. The chair, the table, everything was set, if only the chief's rules could be easily met. The monkey said, "Friend, I'm sure you'll agree. Good friends are just part of one big family." "My chief said, you can become one of us, if you'll eat in a chair, without too much fuss." So the lizard tried. And he tried. And he tried some more. But he always landed on the floor. Sadly, the lizard went home. Later that week, the monkey was walking one day, and he met the lizard, who stopped to say, "Listen, my friend, come to my house and eat. I promise I'll fix you a very special treat." With delight, the monkey asked, "When will this be?" And Candy, the lizard, said, "Tomorrow, I'm free." The lizard hurried home to tell his wife, 'cause they'd never fed a lizard in their entire life. The lizard said, "Monkeys think corn is good food." His wife said, "If I told you what I think, you'd say that I'm rude." The lizard said, "I'm off to see our chief, for I'm sure he'll agree to make our friend the monkey part of our family." When the monkey arrived the next day to dine, everything was prepared, especially fine. The chair, the table, everything was set, if only the chief's rules could be easily met. The monkey sat happily, ready to eat. The corn prepared especially as a tasty treat. The lizard said, "Friend, I'm sure you'll agree. Good friends are just part of one big family. My chief said, you can become one of us. Just make your face white, like mine, without too much fuss." So the monkey washed, and he washed, and he scrubbed his face sore, but alas, he was just as black as before. Now, my friends, it is obvious to see that God's been very busy creating you and me. The question is, do we belong to one big family?
Don't look now. I'm fading away into the gray of my mornings or the blue of every night. Is it that my nails keep breaking? Or maybe the corns on my second little piggy? Things keep popping out on my face or of my life. It seems no matter how I try, I become more difficult to hold. I am not an easy woman to want. They have asked the psychiatrists, psychologists, politicians, and social workers what this decade will be known for. And there is no doubt, it is loneliness. If loneliness were a grape, the wine would be vintage. If it were a wood, the furniture would be mahogany. But since it is life, it is cotton candy on a rainy day. The sweet, soft essence of possibility, never quite maturing. I have prided myself on being in the great tradition, albeit circus, that the show must go on. Though in my community, the vernacular is, one monkey don't stop the show. We all line up at some midway point to thread our way through the boredom and futility, looking for the blue ribbon and the gold medal. Mostly these are seen as food labels. We are consumed by people who sing the same old song, Stay, as sweet as you are in my corner. Or perhaps just a little bit longer. But whatever you do, don't change, baby. Baby, don't change. Something needs to change. Everything, some say, will change. I need a change, a pace, face, attitude in life. Though I long for my loneliness, I know I need something, or someone, or... I strangle my words as easily as I do my tears. I stifle my screams as frequently as I flash my smile. It means nothing. I am cotton candy on a rainy day. The unrealized dream of an idea unborn. I share with the painters the desire to put a three-dimensional picture on a one-dimensional surface.
Got the blues. They brought me on a ship. They were standing over me, standing with a whip. And everybody wants to know why I sing the blues. Well, I've been around a long time. You know, I've really paid my dues, and I stood in line down at the county hall, and I heard a man saying, hey, we're gonna build some apartments for y'all, and everybody knows they wanna know why I'm singing the blues. You, I've been around a long time. It's a long time and I've paid my dues. Born to lose, and everybody around me, people, seems like everybody's got the blues. Well, I've been around a long, long, long time. I really paid my dues. You know, I ain't ashamed to say it now. I love to sing my blues. Well, I thought I would go down welfare and get me some grits and stuff, but the lady stared up at me and said,
Boy, you ain't been around long enough. And that's why I got the blues. I say, I've been around a long time. You know, I really paid my dues.
We cannot merely pray to you, O God, to end war, for we know that you have made the world in a way that man must find his own path to peace, within himself and with his neighbor. We cannot merely pray to you, O God, to end starvation, for you have already given us the resources with which to feed the entire world, if we would only use them wisely. We cannot merely pray to you, O God, to root out prejudice, for you have already given us eyes with which to see the good in all people, if we would only use them rightly. We cannot merely pray to you, O God, to end despair, for you have already given us the power to clear away slums and to give hope, if we would only use our power justly. We cannot merely pray to you, O God, to end disease, for you have already given us great minds with which to search out cures and healing, if we would only use them constructively. Therefore, we pray to you instead, O God, for strength, determination, and willpower to do instead of just to pray, to become instead of merely to wish.
I am a woman.
I am a woman.
I am a woman born of a woman whose man owned a factory.
I am a woman born of a woman whose man labored in a factory.
I am a woman whose man wore silk suits, who constantly watched his weight.
I am a woman whose man wore tattered clothing, whose heart was constantly strangled by hunger.
I am a woman who watched two babies grow into beautiful children.
I am a woman who watched two babies die because there was no milk.
I am a woman who watched twins grow into popular college students with summers abroad.
I am a woman who watched three children grow, but with bellies stretched with from no food.
But then there was a man.
But then there was a man.
And he talked about the peasants getting richer by my family getting poorer.
And he told me of days that would be better, and he made the days better.
We had to eat rice.
We had rice.
We had to eat beans.
We had beans.
My children were no longer given summer visas to Europe.
My children no longer cried themselves to sleep.
And I felt like a peasant.
And I felt like a woman.
A peasant with a dull, hard, unexciting life.
Like a woman with a life that sometimes allowed a song.
And I saw a man.
And I saw a man.
And together, we began to plot with the hope of the return of freedom.
I saw his heart begin to beat with hope of freedom, at least.
Someday, the return to freedom.
Someday, freedom.
And then?
But then.
One day.
One day.
There were planes overhead and guns firing close by.
There were planes overhead and guns firing in the distance.
I gathered my children and went home.
I gathered my children and ran home.
And the guns moved farther and farther away.
But the guns moved closer and closer.
And then they announced that freedom had just been restored.
And then they came, young boys, really.
They came into my home along with my man.
They came and found my man.
Those men whose money was almost gone.
They found all of the men whose lives were almost their own.
And we all had drinks to celebrate.
And they shot them all.
The most wonderful martinis.
They shot my man.
And then they asked us to dance.
And then they came for us.
Me.
For me, the woman.
And my sisters.
For my sisters.
And then they took us.
Then they took us.
They took us to dinner at a small private club.
They stripped from us the dignity we had gained.
And they treated us to beef.
And then they raped us.
It was one course after another.
One after the other, they came at us.
We nearly burst. We were so full.
Lunging, plunging, sisters bleeding, sisters dying.
It was magnificent to be free again.
It was hardly a relief to have survived.
And then we gathered the children together.
And then they took our children.
And he gave them some good wine.
And they took their scissors.
And then we gave them a party.
Then they took the hands of our children.
The beans, they have almost disappeared now.
The beans have disappeared.
The rice, I've replaced it with chicken and steak.
The rice, I cannot find it.
And the parties continue night after night to make up for all the time wasted.
And my silent tears are joined once more by the midnight cries of my children.
And I feel like a woman again.
They say I am a woman.
When a man is singing and cannot lift his voice, and another comes to sing with him, one who can lift his voice, the first will be able to lift his voice too. This is the secret of the bond between the spirits. One of my daughters always says, never go to mother for the facts, just for the truth. I have a story to share with you that came to me from Norway. Actually, it was told to me one evening in Minnesota by Odd Reinseth, who had come to the United States after the Second World War. He and his wife were members of Jerome's first parish, and they had invited us over for the evening. You know how it goes.
in the conversation, something comes up and it sort of triggers a memory. And generally that memory provokes a story. And this is what Odd told me. He said, our city had not been hit yet by the bombs. And yet there was that night at 2 o'clock in the morning when Greta and I awakened to the sirens and we heard the aircraft overhead. And we just got up from our bed, went for our coats, and walked out of the house. It never occurred to us that everything that we owned, that we had all our lives struggled to put together, was in that house. We walked out into those dark streets. Everything was black, except for the flashes of light that were coming from the explosives that were falling. He said, we struggled along those streets, trembling and frightened, and somehow instinctively made our way through the back alleys, feeling our way along over to the road that led us up the hill to the old church that, sad to say, not many people went to anymore. And I prayed in my heart, I hope that basement door is open. And he said, Greta and I stumbled up that hill and found our way and pushed, and the door gave. And we came into the basement, and it was pitch black. And we fell into the corner and held each other and waited. And then it occurred to me, I may be about to die. If I am going to die, I don't want to die like a cowering animal in a wet, dark hole. I want to die like a human being. And somewhere in his mind, there came the old Grundtvigian hymn. It started stirring. Built on a rock, the church does stand, even when steeples are falling. And he began to sing. Crumbled have spires in every land. And he said, he took Greta by the waist, and he said, sing with me. And they stood, and their voices got stronger. And to their absolute amazement, from way across the basement came other voices. We are God's church of living stones, builded for his habitation. And then other voices from over here, and there, and there. And he said, we moved toward one another, listening and singing with all we had in us. My peace I leave with you. Amen. And he said, there in the total darkness, we sang our hymns. Any hymn that we could think of, we sang. And we formed our circle until the aircraft passed and the sun came up and we beheld our faces. And it occurred to me that we had lived. And it occurred to me that must have been a real feast of life.
Near the edge of the Liberian rainforest, on a hill overlooking the Kavali River, was the village of Kundi. Its rice and cassava fields spread in all directions. Cattle grazed in the grassland near the river. Smoke from the fires in the round clay houses seeped through their palm leaf roofs, and from a distance, these faint columns of smoke seemed to hover over the village. Men and boys fished in the river with nets, and women pounded grain in wooden mortars before the houses. In this village, with his wife and many children, lived a hunter by the name of Ogalusa. One morning, Ogalusa took his weapons down from the wall of his house and went into the forest to hunt. His wife and his children went to tend their fields and drove their cattle out to graze. The day passed, and they ate their evening meal of manioc and fish. Darkness came, but Ogalusa didn't return. Another day went by, and still Ogalusa didn't come back. A week passed, then a month. Sometimes Ogalusa's sons mentioned that he hadn't come home. The family cared for the crops and the sons hunted for game, but after a while they no longer talked about Ogalusa's disappearance. Then one day, another son was born to Ogalusa's wife. His name was Puli. Puli grew older. He began to sit up and crawl. The time came when Puli began to talk, and the first thing he said was, the other sons looked across the rice fields. Yes, one of them said. Where is father? He should have returned long ago, another one said. Something must have happened. We ought to look for him, a third one said. He went into the forest, but where will we find him? Another one asked. I saw him go, one of them said. He went that way, across the river. Let us follow the trail and search for him. So the sons took their weapons and started out to look for Ogalusa. When they were deep among the great trees and vines of the forest, they lost the trail. They searched in the forest until one of them found the trail again. They followed it until they lost the way once more, and then another son found the trail. It was dark in the forest, and many times they became lost. Each time another son found the way. At last they came to a clearing among the trees, and there on the ground, scattered about, lay Ogalusa's bones and his rusted weapons. They knew then that Ogalusa had been killed in the hunt. One of the sons stepped forward and said, I know how to put a dead person's bones together. He gathered all of Ogalusa's bones and put them together, each in its right place. Another son said, I have knowledge too. I know how to cover the skeleton with sinews and flesh. He went to work and he covered Ogalusa's bones with sinews and flesh. A third son said, I have the power to put blood into Ogalusa's veins. And then he stepped aside. Another of the sons said, I can put breath into a body. He did his work, and when he was through, they saw Ogalusa's chest rise and fall. I can give the power of movement to a body, another one said. He put the power of movement into his father's body, and Ogalusa sat up and opened his eyes. I can give him the power of speech, another son said. He gave the body the power of speech, and then he stepped back. Ogalusa looked around him. He stood up. Where are my weapons? He asked. They picked up his rusted weapons from the grass where they lay and gave them to him. They then returned the way they had come through the forest and the rice fields until they had arrived once more in the village. Ogallala went into his house. His wife prepared a bath for him, and he bathed. She prepared food for him, and he ate. 4 days he remained in the house, and on the fifth day he came out, shaved his head, because this was what people did when they came back from the land of the dead. Afterwards, he killed a cow for a great feast. He took the cow's tail and braided it. He decorated it with beads and cowrie shells and bits of shiny metal. It was a beautiful thing. Ogallala carried it with him to important affairs. When there was a dance or an important ceremony, he always had it with him. The people of the village thought it was the most beautiful cowtail switch they had ever seen. Soon there was a celebration in the village because Ogallala had returned from the dead. The people dressed in their best clothes, the musicians brought out their instruments, and a big dance began. The drummers beat their drums and the women sang. The people drank much palm wine. Everyone was happy. Ogallala carried his cowtail switch, and everyone admired it. Some of the men grew bold and came forward to Ogallala and asked for the cowtail switch, but Ogallala kept it in his hand. Now and then there was a clamor and much confusion as many people asked for it at once. The women and children begged for it too, but Ogallala refused them all. Finally, he stood up to talk. The dancing stopped and people came close to hear what Ogallala had to say. A long time ago, I went into the forest, Ogallala said. While I was hunting, I was killed by a leopard. Then my sons came for me. They brought me back from the land of the dead to my village. I will give this cowtail switch to one of my sons. All of them have done something to bring me back from the dead, but I have only one cowtail to give. I shall give it to the one who did the most to bring me home. So an argument started. He will give it to me, one of the sons said. It was I who did the most, for I found the trail in the forest when it was lost. No, he will give it to me, another said. It was I who put his bones together. It was I who covered his bones with sinews and flesh, another said. He will give it to me. It was I who gave him the power of movement, another son said. I deserve it most. Another son said it was he who should have the switch because he had put blood in Ogallala's veins. Another claimed it because he had put breath in the body. Each of the sons argued his right to possess the wonderful cowtail switch. Before long, not only the sons, but the other people of the village were talking. Some of them argued that the son who had put blood in Ogallala's veins should get the switch, others that the one who had given Ogallala's breath should get it. Some of them believed that all of the sons had done equal things and that they should share it. They argued back and forth this way until Ogallala asked them to be quiet. To this son I will give the cowtail switch, for I owe most to him, Ogallala said. He came forward and bent low and handed it to Puli, the little boy who had been born while Ogallala was in the forest. The people of the village remembered then that the child's first words had been, "Where is my father?" They knew that Ogallala was right. For it was a saying among them that a man is not really dead until he is forgotten.
To live and to die. There is death in every day, despairs and fears. Fear over our jobs, our children, our finances, our friends, our loneliness, our marriage, our future. Despairs that drown out life. If God did indeed become flesh and dwell among us for all time, how are we to know? Spirit is alive in words and music, in laughter and in smiles, in flowers and in butterflies, in forgiveness, in friendship, in handclasps, in love. Yet, in death, we shut away our hearing ears and seeing eyes, our touching and our caring, our growing, all our sources of creative being. Yet, it is in this dying that we see our meaning. For the eternal spirit can spring to life if there is someone who can love us enough that we dare risk life once again. This is resurrection, the rebirth of hope, that in all death we experience life, that when we are able, we hold out our hand to our brothers and sisters in their despair, giving them a glimpse of that greater love that allows us to do so. This is life, that in the spirit of Jesus, despair cannot overcome. Could it be that from the seeds of suffering and oppression, rejection and utter desolation, springs an inner, stronger compassion, joy, and hope? For our roots have sunk deeper into the knowledge of who we really are, to whom we really belong. Could it be that the desert will really blossom?
Thank you. gently, Lord, and so for all my steps are weak. And ever as I go, some soothing sentence speak, that I may turn my face through doubt's obscurity toward thine abiding place. And though I cannot see, for lo, the way is dark, through mist and clouds I grope, save for that fitful spark, the little flame of hope. Lead gently, Lord, and so for fear that I may fall, I know not where to go unless I hear thy call. My fainting soul doth yearn for thy green hills afar. So let thy mercy burn, my greater guiding star.
This is a fairy tale. It has been unrehearsed. And those of you that feel called to join in the happenings here in the front, please do so. We're going to need King's advisors. There'll be some peasants. There'll be some clowns. There'll be some dukes and lords and barons. And just do what the story says. This is unrehearsed. Once upon a time, there was a country that was both very rich and very poor. Those who were rich were very, very rich, and those who were poor were desperate. It came to pass that the king of that great country wanted to reform the economy and set about to find the best way to do so. He found a group of advisors, who had much experience, much schooling, and leisure time, and asked them to devise a new economic policy that would end corruption and waste. The king's advisors set to work, and they consulted with all of their friends, both at home and in their winter vacation cottages. And they finally, they came up with a new policy and a budget. The king was very happy, because he had promised the people of the kingdom a new day. Now, those around the king and the friends of the advisors were very proud and happy that the new economic program was ready. They urged everyone to support it, even though it would mean some sacrifice. Now, everyone, we're going to support this thing. Now, that's the spirit. The poor peasants, that's right, your cue, were so busy trying to find sustenance that they did not read the decrees about the king's new economic program. Suddenly, they found that the sources of their food were partially cut off. Many of the poor were no longer allowed to get food where they had gotten it before. They were bewildered. But few voices were raised in protest during the first year of the king's economic reform. In the second year of the king's new program, it became evident that the country was going to have the largest deficit in its history, when the new program was supposed to eliminate the deficit entirely. They were a little embarrassed, these advisors. Worried, the king looked and looked to find where he could cut spending. Now, he looked at the plans for increased protection of the kingdom. No, cried his advisors, No, advisors. No, cried his advisors. We cannot afford to be weak in the face of our enemies. And then he looked at tax benefits for the dukes, the lords, and the barons. No, they cried. The dukes? No, dukes? How do you expect us to make the kingdom strong again if we don't have the money to reinvest in the economy? He looked everywhere, this poor king. But there were always strong voices to cry out and object, cry out and object. There was only one place where there was very little protest, the programs for the peasants. The king worried about that a little, but he thought that his advisors might be right. Maybe the peasants didn't protest because they knew they had been ripping off the economy all these years, and that they would welcome a chance to work instead of collecting charity from the kingdom. A few groups tried to speak up on behalf of the poor. A few groups? Anyone? A few groups? All right. Quietly. They soon gave up. Because they had to decide how to use their energies. If they gave too much time to the peasants, they might lose something themselves. And the peasants were not speaking up. If they wouldn't help themselves, why should anyone help them? And thus, the decision was made, dear king, to cut benefits for the peasants in order to avoid bankruptcy. The results were difficult to discern at first. Then it became evident that food for peasant children was cut way down, while tax deductibility for business lunches for the dukes and the barons remained intact. You're supposed to like this. Self-help programs for the elderly would be eliminated, while lobbying expenses for those who built weapon systems would continue. Housing assistance for the poor would be slashed, while tax-free interest on home mortgages would continue to benefit mostly the dukes, the lords, and the barons. A small, very small, muffled cry began to go up to the heavens. Would no one have compassion? Would no one hear the wail of the suffering, the wail of the suffering? All right, already. Cut. But wait, what's this? A sign of hope flashed in the sky, discerned only by a few. It was a silent, secret call to the compassionate ones. How did it happen? Listen on. There was in the kingdom a small, very small group of clowns who lived among the people, working and living just like the rest most of this time. Secretly and silently, they sometimes gathered to celebrate another way of being, a way that had more to do with relating than with reading, with playing than with working. They were simple people with antennae sensitive to the sorrows and the joys of others. When times were good, the people of the kingdom would ignore and sometimes ridicule them and put down their ways. Would you ridicule and put down their ways, please? All right, very good. The clowns would hurt in silence during those times. In times of trouble, though, people would seek them out for comfort and consolation. Would someone seek them out for comfort and consolation, please? For they knew that the clowns would love them no matter what. But times had been good for so many years that the clowns had felt pretty useless for a very long time. Then the new economic program was devised. At first, the clowns knew nothing about the changes because they didn't like reading those kinds of things too much. They only found out about it because of the suffering of those around them, the suffering, the peasants, the suffering of those around them, the clowns. The peasants were in tears. Oh boy, do they do it up. Others who had never been poor suddenly found themselves without work and experiencing critical times. The advisors, of course, don't see this. The clowns were so astounded at the pervasiveness of the problem that they gathered in clusters to determine what to do. Clowns, gather in clusters. We need some more clowns. Gathering in clusters to determine what to do. We got some clowns coming up. Okay, we got enough clowns to gather in clusters here. Here we go. The clowns decided to send out an ancient signal to the compassionate ones. It was a secret call to gather to see how the compassionate ones could bring healing to a desperate situation. Thus it was, and here many of you may wish to join, thus it was that the clowns, the mimes, the poets, the dancers, the dramatists, are there no dancers, dramatists, clowns, mimes, poets, artists, singers, healers, prayers, and many others gathered together to find out from one another what could be done. They're gathering together to find out what could be done, and some of you might want to join them. We have a nice crowd of compassionate ones here. Of course, everyone sitting down is also a compassionate one. Their decision was simple. Since they really did not understand economic programs, they would simply concentrate on communicating what they did understand, the suffering of the poor. They promised one another to go about the land and tell the story of the peasants in their own mediums and ways so that the rest of the subjects in the kingdom could hear and help. There was much excitement. Excitement? Excitement. The writers promised to write about it. The media people promised to film it. The photographers promised to take pictures that told the story, and the rest were to compose poems and skits, cartoons, dances, prayers, liturgies, and many other vehicles to get the word out. And they go about the land. They go back to their own place, back to your own place. You are getting the word out, you see. Well, what happened? We really don't know yet. The process has just begun. But may God guide their efforts.
The Word was made flesh in Nazareth and in Africa, in America and in Asia, in Russia, Germany, and Norway, in Vietnam, Korea, and Japan. The Word was made flesh in Mexicans, Englishmen, Irish, and Polish, in Arabs, Indians, Canadians, Eskimos, and in Portuguese. Brazilians and Nigerians. The Word was made flesh in poor people, rich, plain, short, and tall people, in doctors and parents, children and teachers, in lawyers and plumbers, in dancers and singers, and in you and me. We have received a promise. One day we will be brought back together with God and with each other.
Our Father, who art in heaven.
Heilige sind ihr Name.
Tillkomme ditt rike.
Hattau anie nici chapunau.
On earth as it is in heaven.
Daici svonia nam nasha I shednievo klebam.
Perdona nos el mal que hemos hecho.
Kai gar autoi affirmen panti offerenti hemen.
Laio gonesio I frashtinga.
Me dirivenu du mal.
Nan guvu na utukufu.
I dream a world where man no other will scorn, where love will bless the earth and peace its paths adorn. I dream a world where all will know sweet freedom's way, where greed no longer saps the soul, nor avarice blights the day. A world of dream where black or white, whatever race you be, will share the bounties of the earth, and where every man, woman, and child will be free, where wretchedness will hang its head, and joy, like a pearl, will attend the needs of all humankind. Of such, I dream our world.
We will conclude if you open up your hymn book to 448. It's a little different version. Jesse will sing the first verse and join on the second, Amazing Grace.
Whoa.